From Colombo, Malaysia, this is Season Podcast.
Welcome to the May 2019 edition of the Season Podcast. Mark and I are very pleased about the fact that you can join us again on this occasion. My name is Ole Rummel, and I'm the Director of Macroeconomic and Monetary Policy Management at the CSUN Center. With me is my colleague Mark McKenzie, who will introduce himself.
Hello again. My name is Mark McKenzie. I'm a Senior Financial Sector Specialist in the Financial Stability and Supervision stream at the CSUN Center.
Joining us today is Deputy Governor Jessica Chu from Bank Negara, Malaysia. She has over 26 years of experience in financial sector supervision and regulation with the bank. At the moment, she's responsible for financial stability, which covers the regulation and supervision of banks, insurance companies, payment systems, and money services. Jessica represents the bank as an advisor member of the Malaysian Accounting Standards Board. In addition, she holds a Chartered Banker qualification from the Chartered Banker Institute in Scotland, a fellow Chartered Banker of Asian Institute of Chartered Bankers, and she is an associate member of CPA Australia. Jessica graduated from the University of Melbourne, Australia, with a Bachelor of Commerce degree majoring in accounting and finance. We are talking with Jessica today about a number of topics having to do with financial system stability and in particular cybersecurity in the run-up to our policy summit, the CSUN Policy Summit, taking place on 13th and 14th of June, to which you're all invited.
We're delighted that you are able to join us, Deputy Governor. We know that the Bank Negara recently published its financial stability report, and we wish to engage you this afternoon on the primarily subject of cybersecurity, mm-hmm. but perhaps you'd like to share your thought from a financial stability mm-hmm. perspective, first and foremost. Give us a global view as to what you see as the risk today from that global perspective, and then drive us to a regional and then to a local level.
Yeah. Sure, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be speaking with you today. At a global level, I think the key risks from a financial stability perspective are still centered around the slower global growth momentum that we are now facing, as well as high debt levels that remain in several large economies. There has been a build-up of leverage, in some cases quite significantly, both in developed and emerging economies, and this will continue to be a concern. I think if you put that in the context as well of the fact that with expectations of slower global growth, financial conditions are likely to be remain easy for some time, and that itself, while staving off perhaps some of the concerns around a sharper economic slowdown, it does create the conditions that could encourage a further build-up of leverage and underpricing of risk. And so these are things and issues that will continue to occupy, I believe, financial stability authorities, at least at a global level. It is also true, I think, that there is considerable political uncertainty that we believe also presents added risks in this environment. And the experience to date, clearly suggests that this goes well beyond just political rhetoric. It has real implications for economic and financial activities, Brexit, trade tensions, and in some cases, even potentially the risk of undermining institutions that are important in a country for financial stability. So I think all of this will continue to weigh on growth prospects in financial markets and at a time when debt levels remain relatively high. Just talking about to the subject of cyber security and operational risks as well. These are clearly a further and increasingly significant concern given the more pervasive use of technology in the provision of financial services. So we are now in an environment where there are interconnected networks, there is increasing operational dependence on technology, and a particular concern that is emerging as well is the concentration in a few third-party service providers. So that's becoming, for want of a better word, it is becoming more prominent when we talk about cyber risks.
May I interject there, Deputy Governor? So with respect to the ASEAN region and localize some of the risks that you have identified, are there any particular concerns from a regional perspective?
I think for emerging economies only in the region, one of the issues that we face is the potential for some of the risks that I've discussed at the global level being amplified because of the volatility of portfolio flows for particularly the more open economies, and Malaysia falls into that category as well. It's worth noting that in the recent IMF's Global Financial Stability Report, I think this point was underscored when that report made reference to an increasing share of portfolio flows to emerging markets now that are largely driven by benchmark indicators. So these are sentiment-driven flows, fairly, you know, indiscriminate with respect to the fundamentals of the economy. And I think for smaller, open, emerging economies, that is a challenge, an added challenge that we face when we're dealing with, you know, some of these global issues. Just speaking at the regional level, and particularly in the context of Malaysia, we, as you mentioned, just published a financial stability report. So there are a number of risks that we flag. Household debt has been an area that we've been vigilant over for some years now, and we do see signs that that risk is stabilizing. So certainly in Malaysia's case, it has come off from, you know, much higher levels, and the pace of growth of household debt has also stabilized. We've also flagged risks around commercial property real estate, and this is something that you know, we think will continue to face some pressure because we're still looking at large incoming supply of office space. And I suppose, you know, I did want to say, though, that the region as a whole is in a much better position to respond to this risk. And I think that's an important point to make. You know, we have much stronger financial systems following the Asian financial crisis. Many of us have much deeper financial markets than 2 decades ago. And very importantly, I think the region has really come together from a supervision point of view, from a surveillance perspective. There has been very notable strengthening in the cooperation arrangements that exist in the region. And I think that's really sometimes underappreciated. You know, when we talk about the resilience of the region and the ability to respond to developments that can affect financial stability. So the regional forums that we have, it is at multiple levels. It is, you know, we have groups that are groups of banking supervisors that come together, and even that, it is at several levels, you know, from the working levels right up to very senior levels. We have, you know, our treasury operations that are linked across the region, and I'll come to that in a bit. We also have, you know, groups now focused on IT security issues. So many of us have been, you know, in this area. We can really see it's a very notable coming together in a very practical way of supervisors, and I think that's something that is often underplayed and perhaps underappreciated in terms of the resilience of the region. So I'd say, yes, there are risks in the region, but I also say that, you know, we are in a much better position to respond.
Can I follow that up with a question? I'm very reassured by a much stronger regulatory or supervisory framework that exists. But you also mentioned topics such as household debt and commercial property, which takes us right back to the banking sector, the banking system, the individual banks, which lie at the heart of the financial system. So in terms of the challenges and the risks that you've outlined at the global, regional, and even national level, how prepared do you think banks are? So we know from what you tell us that the supervisors and central banks are prepared, but what about the individual banks or banking systems as such?
And before you answer that one, DG, perhaps you could also amplify for us, how does technology help to extenuate this risk as well?
Yeah, sure. No, absolutely. I think the banking system, banking institutions, so even if you look at capital levels from, during the crisis and where we are now, I mean, the capital buffers have increased substantially. But a lot of the reforms around governance, risk management, capital and liquidity actually predated, many of the Basel III initiatives. So we learned from the Asian financial crisis. And I think in a number of economies in this region, a lot of the reforms in the banking system were done at that time or started at that time. And certainly the banking institutions today and the banking system today are in a much stronger position as well. Aside from institutional strength, I think we've also moved ahead in terms of resolution recovery plans. So that's, again, contributing to stronger resilience of the banking system. Governance and risk management have been areas that we as supervisors have been very much focused on, and the banks have also made some significant improvements in how they are organizing themselves to manage risk both at the institutional and the group-wide level. So certainly I would say without question that the banking system is in a much stronger position. So coming to the role of technology, that does introduce a new dimension, I suppose, to the risks that we face. We did start out looking at technology risks as an extension of operational risk. And I think, views have evolved now that it is really an area, and if you talk about cyber risk and technology risk more generally, it is an area that deserves much stronger focus. And I think for a number of reasons, because technology risk and cyber in particular, if we can get into the area, has a number of differences from your typical financial and operational risk. Number one, it is typically when we're talking about cyber attacks, and maybe I'm jumping the gun a little bit
that's perfect.
We're talking about cyber attacks, the differences lie in the fact that typically they are planned over a longer term, right? And therefore, the potential to inflict significant damage, whether it's on an institution or the system as a whole, can be done in a much more targeted and deliberate way, rather than what we typically experience as random episodes of operational risks, right? That's one. So the timing of it is quite, it's controlled, it is deliberate. It is also intentional. I think these attackers are typically people who have malicious intent, and that differentiates it as well from your operational, risk type events that we've been used to dealing with in the past. I think those two dimensions, coupled with the fact that, as I said, there has been a much more rapid diffusion of technology in the provision of financial services. So you bring all that together, then technology risk, in our assessment at least, certainly deserves a particular level of focus and attention, and does require us to think somewhat differently about, appropriate responses.
If I can again follow up on that, I mean, you mentioned the new service providers, you mentioned platforms. Now, one of the issues that I find very interesting and also a bit worrying has to do with, for example, financial innovation and the fact that a lot of these platform providers are not banks. So a lot of financial services are moving away from the financial sector and are being handled by firms that have a telecommunications background, that have a sort of a platform background, that may even have, if you look at Gojek in Indonesia and Grab in Southeast Asia in general, that have no financial background whatsoever. And we have these firms gaining a large market share in financial services, largely outside of the regulated banking sector or the regulated financial services sector. How should we think about dealing or thinking about those companies?
And if I may to that, given that following the Asian crisis, the improvement around governance and those kind of aspects for banking, how do we then address that aspect within these new providers as well?
Yeah. So the new providers, you know, if you think about the issues that tend to destabilize financial systems, it's leverage, it's maturity, transformation, right? I think what we've seen in where these platform providers and all coming in has been, for the most part, in the payment, very much in the payment space. And at least in Malaysia, and I think in more countries now, you know, there are efforts, if not already, measures in place to ensure that they do come within the scope of payment regulatory frameworks. And I think that is the right thing to do. Because, you know, disruptions in the payment system obviously is something that does need to be managed. So one of the issues that we are addressing our minds to is, you know, we have, or we mandate, in fact, interoperable shared infrastructure platforms. And this is to allow, you know, to benefit from the network effects of payment systems. But the challenge with that is ensuring that, you know, these perhaps non-traditional, non-bank players in the market are not exposing the broader system to risk because different, you know, standards apply. And so that is where it is really important that consistent standards, particularly around the management of risks, is applied to all participants. And for us, we do try and make a distinction between perhaps smaller players that do not have the same level of systemic exposure, and the larger ones that are plugged into your broader platforms. And, you know, if something happens to them, then the disruption to the system is much more material. So I think that would be the first point, that the risk management standards have to be clear and they have to be applied evenly and consistently to participants in the financial system, material significant participants in the financial system. To the point about governance around, you know, at the institutional level, I think we have just in Malaysia raised our expectations significantly around risk management in the area of technology and cyber risk. So we're just about to finalize an issue, the policy document that we consulted with the industry for some time on strengthened standards around risk management and technology. So that's coming out shortly. And we believe that this will, you know, it will capture our expectations for much higher standards to be met, particularly actually around governance. So we are, for example, creating a clear expectation that we do expect a dedicated board oversight committee to be focused on technology risk. We do believe that particularly for larger institutions, it is just not tenable for technology to be one of several things that just comes under, you know, the board more generally, which for some institutions has been the case. We are also raising standards around the second and third lines of defense in responding to risk. So, for example, we require a chief information and security officer to be designated within institutions who will be responsible for managing technology risk. So this is ensuring that, you know, in addition to a lot of focus investments are going into the first line, right, the operational responses to issues around technology. There hasn't been, in our assessment, enough focus around the second and the third lines of defense. So it's audit and risk management have been areas in particular where we see that there's been an insufficient attention to capacity building, making sure that, you know, institutions have the right people in place to be able to provide a robust risk environment.
I sincerely appreciate you saying that, because for our policy summit, two things we thought about in our policy summit. One is around leadership,
yep,
and governance,
yep,
and the other is around competencies. So we see competency, enhancing of competency, as one of the role, the function in terms of how we strengthen the cybersecurity. So is this something that you're articulating to your institution, that leadership is essential, having
Absolutely.
The right people in places? Is that what you're saying to us?
Absolutely. I think some of the things that we require is, for one, that the boards have to set a clear, actually, risk appetite around technology risk. And that will then set the tone for, you know, the investments that need to go into managing that risk within the appetite that has been set by the board. It will go into, you know, how business decisions are made. And I think that's also worth emphasizing, that what we want to see, you know, in the long run, is there is a greater integration between technology risk considerations and business decisions and business strategies. And in, you know, it is true that in some institutions they're largely managed separately, and we don't quite see that integration coming together. And this has to start, as you say, from the tone at the top. Yeah.
Can I be a bit more skeptical in this
yeah.
regard? Simply because being a recipient of a cyber attack is very embarrassing
yeah.
for a firm.
Yeah.
And I personally don't know how many attacks are made public, and probably a central bank has much more information about these attacks, but not the broader public or even the region or on a sort of global scale. So it may be a national attack. Mm-hmm. The central bank knows about it, the firm knows about it, but no one else
yeah.
does.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering whether there's how we can A, get around the sort of stigma of
yeah.
being having been hacked or something,
yeah.
and B, what the role of information sharing is,
yeah.
how we can foster information
yeah.
sharing, because I mean, attack on one is
yes.
an attack on all.
Yes. Now, that's a really good point, because in fact that's continues to be quite a challenge, the confidence with which institutions are prepared to share information around cyber attacks. So this is something that we've engaged quite extensively with the industry on, and we are this year we've already commenced work to establish something called the Financial Intelligence and Threat
Threat Intelligence Platform,
which is really, for one, it's actually an arrangement where we collate information, the central bank does, and then, you know, that is analyzed, and then that is shared with the industry, and, you know, with sufficient anonymity in a way, but it is to highlight that these are the MOs, and, you know, then allow for industry to benefit from that information. That is happening at the industry level. We are obviously encouraging, you know, the industry itself to also have arrangements. But we believe that, and in a number of countries, I think in the region, the authority has stepped in to play that role to kind of overcome some of the stigma, because institutions tend to be more confident sharing information with the authority, and then, you know, that is analyzed and that is disseminated more broadly across the industry. So that's one way, but I don't believe that that's going to be quite key if, you know, that we do come to reach a place where we are able to facilitate effective and efficient flows of information, and in a very real time and quick basis to allow institutions, to respond.
If I could just add on to the sharing of information and cooperation. So it's not just with institutions sharing information in a trust central. What about at the regional level as well? Is there a need for enhanced cooperation, information and sharing as well to combat the risk of cybersecurity risk as well?
In our experience, if there is an incident, I think because, as I mentioned, of the cooperation that's been built over the years, we've actually had experiences where that information flows very quickly and very efficiently. What we perhaps could work on is the more regular, I suppose, not necessarily incident-specific information, because that flows really in a very effective way. But it's the more general surveillance, and monitoring of developments in cyberspace and, what are some of the trends that we're seeing at the national level, and being able to exchange information around that more regularly and systematically is something that I think would benefit regulators. And in fact, there are platforms that are being created precisely to facilitate that. So, for example, I'll just mention a few of them. There is, at the international level, an international IT supervisory group. At the IMIAP level, the working group on banking supervisors do regularly, have an agenda now where IT risk developments are discussed. And at the ASEAN level as well, there is a Cybersecurity Resilience and Information Sharing Platform, or CRISP, as they call it. So the recognition is there that, information flows and exchange is absolutely critical to defend against cyber risk. At the same time, work is being done to make sure that, these arrangements are able to be operationalized as efficiently and as effectively as possible.
I have one burning question around cybersecurity, and it's on the subject of insurance for cybersecurity. Yeah. I wonder if you have any thoughts on using insurance as a risk mitigation tool for cybersecurity.
Well, I think globally, I had a look at some of the numbers. The insurance take-up, cyber insurance take-up, has increased in recent years. In the last 5 years, the numbers that I looked at showed that it's increased from $1 billion US dollars in 2011 to something in the region of $3.25 billion US dollars. This is from the Information Institute of Insurance. And the estimates project that this will reach about US dollars 20 billion in 2025. The thing about cyber insurance is that they cover third-party liability generally and direct costs associated with a breach. And while that's obviously useful from a firm's perspective, it doesn't go anywhere near far enough to cover the losses from business interruptions and disruptions. And I think that is the practical limitation of the usefulness of cyber insurance. So if we talk about financial institutions, then clearly I don't believe cyber insurance comes anywhere near being able to deal with some of the risks and issues that we've talked about. But I think there is potential for the information that is gathered from the insurers that are insuring non-financial firms about nature of cyber threats, and how it's evolved and all that. That information, if we could harness that in a way, that could be useful to financial institutions in building their resilience against cyber threats. I think that would be something, that is useful. But to rely on cyber insurance, for financial institutions to rely on cyber insurance as an effective mitigant against cyber risk, I think is misguided. And I don't think really anyone really believes that that provides any kind of a solution. So, it is really about strengthening cyber resilience. And cyber insurance is probably a very small part, at least for the foreseeable future, it's probably going to be a very small part of that.
But you mentioned strengthening cyber resilience, but again, that requires human resources.
Yes.
And we know that the skills required to prevent or to enhance cybersecurity are the same skills that others abuse for the purposes of malicious attacks and all that. So sort of another issue that frequently comes up is, are there enough computer science engineers, computer science graduates, people with these particular skills that would allow firms to defend themselves, to boost their cybersecurity? So are you concerned about the lack of skills and competence, or that this may be a problem going forward?
Yeah. Well, I think the shortage of talent is not a new issue. It's, you know, we face this when risk management, you know, was clearly an issue that we felt there was a lack of competence in that area. You know, we confronted it when we felt that in the insurance sector, you know, there was a lack of actuarial expertise at the time and a shortage of talent around, you know, actuaries that we needed. And one thing that I noticed is that's much less of an issue today. And for one of the big reasons has been because of the supervisory regulatory expectations. So as the bar gets raised around what we need financial institutions to deliver in terms of their capacity to manage this risk, it creates that momentum and traction for, you know, whether it is for the universities to, you know, design programs to, you know, produce talent that will be able to meet this need. So it is, I suppose what I'm trying to say is it's not, it is certainly an issue. Shortage of talent is an issue, and it is a challenge for many of our economies. But I think it is about, you know, making sure that everybody's working towards closing that talent gap. And our experience has been that it very much starts with, well, what is it that we need banks and insurance companies, right, to have in place to be able to manage this risk? And once those expectations are set, generally it does create that momentum for some of these challenges to be met. But there are a couple of other things that we probably want to apply our minds to, which is, I think we need to rethink where we source this talent. So the traditional places where we typically source talent for financial services industry, in the area of cyber risk, we probably need to open up to other areas, for example, you know, from the military, from defense, you know. And I think institutions are starting to look outside the circle of the financial community to source the talent that's required to respond to cyber. The other thing that will become more important, I believe, from a talent perspective within institutions is that means that you have talent that may not necessarily know financial business, but they are, you know, excellent in cyber. So financial institutions are going to need to figure out how they bring these skills and expertise together. And that's going to be more prominent in the area of tech risk, because it's rare that you find, you know, someone, or at least it'll take some time before someone with that tech competencies are able to also acquire, you know, the sort of financial and business skill set. So I think within organizations, you know, there needs to be some thought as to how do you bring this knowledge and skills and expertise together. So these are some of the changes that I think will need to happen within financial institutions to address the talent and competence issue.
Okay, so I mean, we're coming to the end of our session. So if I could ask you from the perspective as the deputy governor, what are those things that keeps you up at night from a cybersecurity perspective, and how would you wrap this session up for us, speaking to your institution to say these are the 3, 4, 5 things that you should have in place?
Well, we're very clear about our expectations around risk and governance around technology risk. So that's number one. The second thing that I perhaps should mention is we really do need to strengthen our incident response capability. So I mentioned earlier about, you know, how cyber threats differ from others' operational and financial risks that we're accustomed to dealing with. And that requires that we, it's not just the preventive and detective measures that need to be thought through, it's also, well, let's assume an incident. We have to assume that, you know, every institution is going to be at some point attacked and potentially successfully attacked, then the incident's recovery and response capability, I think, will be crucial. And that's certainly something that we are focusing a lot of attention on. I do think that there will be much stronger coordination and cooperation around information flows and exchange as we start to, you know, get familiar with protocols and get more confident in how we can share information across institutions and across borders around cyber threats. I would, you know, as to what keeps me awake at night, I think it's really that our ability to respond effectively and quickly in a cyber incident, I believe, remains for the most part, actually not just here, but, you know, in many other places, untested. I think that is something that we all really need to devote some resources, time, and attention to making sure that, you know, that that is in place. I would just also want to kind of add as a last note that cyber risk is something that needs to be embraced at the entire organizational level. So it is not an issue for the IT department or, you know, and I think that is something that we are not seeing absorbed within institutions as much as we'd like to see. So this is about, you know, having a high level of cyber hygiene within institutions and everybody understanding that they have a role to play individually to strengthen institutions' defenses against cyber risk. So the conversations will continue, no doubt, and we have double our own headcount within the bank. So I think our own supervisory capacity, the risk management capacity of institutions are things that, you know, as a financial stability authority, you know, we really need to step up over the next few years.
So from an enterprise-wide perspective, everyone needs to own cyber.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's delightful. Certainly what I've heard from you in the last 30 minutes or so is that from a financial stability perspective, the region has been very well prepared in terms of their issues, but they're being addressed. From a cybersecurity perspective, there are a number of things that we need to cover. Governance, we need to have it embraced at an enterprise-wide level, and a couple of other things. So we're truly delightful for these points.
Yes, and I would also like to thank you very much for your insights and for sharing with us your experience and just your global, regional, and national views about cybersecurity. And again, I'm shamelessly plugging our policy summit on the 13th or 14th of June. And if you want to know more about all of these issues, come and join us in Sasana Kijang in Kuala Lumpur on those dates. So Deputy Governor Chu, thank you so much for being with us today. I hope the experience wasn't too stressful, and we would obviously always welcome you back onto to our podcast.
Thank you.